come 15 minutes late to the Thursday edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor, here in Santa Cruz. We are coming straight from a city council meeting, or actually nearly straight from a city council meeting. I have an in-studio guest who's probably going to talk to us once he takes a breather and we all settle down here and figure out what we're doing. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norse, and this is a usually a two-hour show from 6 to 8 on all kinds of local topics ranging from the sleeping ban to police abuse to wild and crazy music, reports from other cities, basically around rights of people who are poor and or outside, with an occasional focus on the drug war. So that's what I do, and I'm pleased to be with you here today. I'm going to be scrounging and scrambling a bit because I got here, as I said, a little bit late, and I'm going to kind of try to make it all right, and that's going to involve a little doing because it's a little bit behind the scene at the moment. If you want to call in to this show, in case you want to help me stall here and get it together, the phone number here is 427-3772, 427-3772. I'm going to actually give you an opportunity to hear a little gentler music. Here's some Jim Page, and I'll be back with you shortly. Don't go away.
Tubular bells that make a tubular sound, and they're rolling balls that go rolling around. Everything is round. You can fantasize the straight line, you can try it if you may, but I guarantee that straight line is gonna turn around someday. Everything is round. There's a crazy man beating on a big skin drum, and everybody waiting on the kingdom come, while every other kingdom just comes undone. Everything is round. Starting from the Mother Earth, learning what a circle's worth, returning to the place of birth, and everything is round. You can calculate the answer, you can call it MC squared, but if space and time are true, be curved, then there are no squares out there. Everything is round. Good speak, he'd have to say, forget about the judgment day, there's no straight and narrow anyway. Everything is round. Entropy and institution, a convoluted evolution, revolving every revolution, and everything is round. Everything is round. Everything is round. Everything. Thank you.
And that was Jim Page, and now it's Robert Norris in the studio with you, live, not on tape. And you can actually catch me on the phone and be live yourself. 427-3772 is the number of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We do accept calls. We don't censor you. If you start rambling, we may cut you off or possibly just start grunting and sneezing at you. You never can tell. We get pretty rude here at Free Radio. Actually, we're pretty polite most of the time. Again, the topic's civil rights for the poor, and I just came from a poor excuse for civil rights, or actually housing for poor people, from City Council. Normally, City Council meets on Tuesdays, every second and fourth Tuesday, but for some reason today, it met on the third Thursday. Now, of course, I normally would applaud more council meetings on topics provided people are informed in advance of what is going on. The topics today on the afternoon agenda, and there actually is an evening if you want to go down to City Council at 7 o'clock. I think they're doing the downtown, kind of the housing element downtown on the Front Street. I don't think that's quite it, but it's kind of in that general vicinity in terms of what they're talking about. But this afternoon they talked about two subjects that are important to me. One is homeless services, and then they segued into Dolphin Lee, the bulldoze the beach flats plan that apparently has a 6-1 vote. At least it has one vote against it, and a surprising vote, or perhaps not so surprising if you've been following the way things are going. Mark Premack, a man who I voted against, who has refused to return my phone calls, who is one of the few people who has lots of good things to say about the sleeping ban, or some crazy things, like there wouldn't be a sleeping ban if only there weren't sleeping ban protesters that were the ones causing all the trouble. He's kind of a right-wing fellow in many ways. On this issue, he said some very important things and some true things, and I'm going to play what he did say before the council did their own bulldozing 6-1 vote. What was up today was a long-delayed and concealed plan that Mercy Charities has ever since last July, when the tenants rebelled and said, "We don't want your stinking housing without guarantees." With guarantees, that'll be fine. Guarantees meaning the guarantee that we actually will be able to come back to it and won't be told to take a hike and have somebody else get in there or just get selected out for many of the reasons that Mercy Charities Housing does, ranging from bad credit to prior unlawful detainers to felony convictions to, well, and the question arose, what about, undocumented alien status? That, of course, was one that Mercy Charities said they would not stop people from entering housing on, but they were unclear about their funding sources, and some funding sources don't allow funding for undocumented aliens. I think they should, but I'm more concerned that the rights of the tenants there be protected and have been all along. Plus, I'd like to see more affordable housing rather than less, and I'd like to see that a real process establishes it and not some kind of closed-door backroom deal where Mercy Charities has its votes lined up and simply just sort of watches everyone bends over and bows as they pass, which is really kind of what's been going on at City Council. They've just been trying to find anything they can do to ratify this Mercy Charities housing project, which creates less housing than it destroys in the beach flats. Destroys three apartment buildings, the Lee, the Dolphin, and has already bulldozed the Rex Court with 63 units and sets up 48 units at a cost of $16 million. I used to think it was $12.5 million. Remember, the audience drew my attention to the fact that it suddenly escalated $4 million, similar to our dear police station, which went from, what, $6 million to $13 million, or was it $5 million to $12.5 million? I'm not quite sure. But somewhere in that vicinity, all the while the city manager muttering, "Oh, no, no, there's no real expansion," and Chris Crone nodding judiciously. That's Candy Graham Crone, one of our council members who we had hoped to would be an activist. Remember in those old days when he actually fought for, or said he was fighting for rights for people in the beach flats? Those were the days. Anyway, it's your show, it's my show, and unfortunately today at City Council it was their show. Mercy Charities Housing had the room packed, not with tenants, but with, frankly, little old ladies from SCAN and from Women's International League for Peace and Freedom who had not heard the other side, who had not been exposed to the realities of it, and who were rubber-stamping the project because people like Ruth Hunter and Bernice Belton were leading the charge. Bernice Belton, of course, is a co-chair of SCAN, but she also sits on the secret Mercy Charities Housing Advisory Board, which holds closed meetings and has been doing so for a year. We were presented with a distorted chronology from Elizabeth Vogel, who runs Mercy Charities Housing's I guess it's her, she's the developers, developing side. I'm not quite sure exactly what her position is, but she's often up there giving the pep talks and the so-called informational talks to the city council. And it was interesting what they had a slideshow trying to show that Mercy Charities is somehow cheaper or just as cheap as market rate housing in terms of its cost for building. We had seen before that their cost for building is about twice what you would get if you go to a private developer, maybe not quite twice, I don't know, 1 3/4 times as much. And she presented these statistics out of the blue, which none of us had had access to. There was no indication of this stuff in the city council packet. When I tried to get it, she told me she'd give it to me later, so I went to the city clerk and I said, "Leslie, the city council is getting information that the public is being denied." Leslie went and got the information and copied it up. But no, of course, none of us had a chance to examine it beforehand. Not that it would have made a lot of difference, because city council is determined to proceed to rubber stamp Mercy Charities housing. I mean, if they were discovered running around naked, raping children at high noon, I think they'd think of something like, "Oh goodness, this is merely some sort of a deviant practice." But let's not forget the great low income housing they're going to provide. Well, I talked at some length. Actually, I talked at 3 minutes, a very short length. Everybody else talked at great length, at least on the council. They went on at some, and Mercy Charities talked forever, of course, with their proposals. You know, I thought we had voted in folks, council members, who knew that you don't just take it from the staff. You don't just sort of lie down and, you know, take it up the yin-yang because the staff says it's the way it is. And the only person who had any really probing questions was Mark Premack, and he's the one who voted against it. And now I'm now going to play you the final speech he made, which was quite impressive. And much as I detest Premack's errors, don't like his agenda, find his manner of dealing with the public violates my public process in terms of any kind of accessibility to him. He's a prejudiced person, in other words, in terms of how he relates to me. Nonetheless, listen to what he had to say, and, well, you be the judge. This happened about 45 minutes ago at City Council.
So we would need to have that paper.
First, you're going to hear Kim Fitzgerald.
What a replacement housing plan essentially does present a general legal document that says this is the number of units we intend to replace, this is the configuration of those units, those kinds of questions. It's not going to tell you where the windows are, how tall the building is, or anything like that. It's just going to say this is what the intention is, presents that intention to the public, and then the public looks at this as a real project. I mean, my general feeling is, how long do people have to say, "Get moving on it"? How often do they have to say it? How often do the people in the Dolphin apartments have to come here every Tuesday night? They haven't missed a meeting in the last 2 months that I've noticed, or the people at 204 Riverside. And I've been down, I went down to their neighborhood last week, and they were preparing for our last meeting. They gave that presentation at our last meeting and said, "This is a presentation that essentially says, do something."
Of course, what Mayor Fitzmaurice isn't saying is that the people from the Dolphin were orchestrated to come down by their Mercy Charities housing landlords, the new landlords that the city has installed. Actually, the city gave Mercy Charities the money to buy the Dolphin and essentially gave them the property to be theirs in perpetuity after 20 years, provided they maintain subsidized housing for the folks involved. I think it's either in perpetuity or 20 years they have to maintain the subsidized housing. And indeed, Mercy Charities, under the city direction, and lowered the rent $50. Yeah, that's nice. And then they compiled a very strange, very limited list of people who supposedly lived there, which was about half the number of people that we had estimated lived there before when Maria Gutierrez told us, gave us estimates. She was the previous manager under the old owner McElroy, of how many people were in the Dolphin apartment complex. Much smaller number. And why the smaller numbers? Well, perhaps Maria Gutierrez was wrong. Or perhaps Mercy Charities wanted to estimate a lower number of people so that they would be responsible for less relocation money, and they would be responsible for planning less replacement housing. There's always that possibility. And frankly, I find it not entirely out of the question. So, Mayor Fitzmaurice here is talking about, let's go ahead, come on, we've waited long enough, But long enough to do what? Long enough to establish a housing project in 2 or 3 years for a fraction of the people who had previously lived there. And indeed, to some extent, we're arguing over graves because the Rex Court has already been bulldozed and the people in the Rex Court were in essence dispersed by the Seaside Company, in my mind, in collusion with the city, who then bought the property and bulldozed all the housing that was on it without it being red tagged, without there being any kind of refurbishing study. And every time I bring that up at City Council, no one answers that. And the same thing was true today. Nobody said, well, the reason there was no refurbishing study is because, or it didn't have to be red tagged because. Instead, they simply ignore it. And that, is, in essence, is what has happened throughout this whole process. The Mercy Charities Housing presented a plan, presented a program, and it was rubber-stamped from the very first to, it looks like, the very last. Though, in fact, what they did today was told the staff to go ahead and look into it. They also are engaging in slimy business around the Lee property, which is the one apartment complex that initially resisted them, with the organization Residentes Unidos saying, we don't want the Dolphin Lee project here, our housing torn down in some new Mercy Charities housing run project built here, unless there are, first of all, we can get into it, unless we have input into it, unless other bidders than Mercy Charities bids on it. That, of course, meant that they wanted to cut the Lee out completely of the process, and they did last summer. But they've still been holding secret meetings and closed sessions, City Council has, on the issue of acquiring the Lee property, in my mind, in violation of the law. That is, the law that requires the citizenry to be informed of what's going on and these matters not be discussed in closed session when they've already been taken off the agenda in open session. You can talk about property acquisition behind closed doors if it's a fit subject because you brought it back through an open process and said, we're now going to be discussing this. No, instead, they discussed it behind closed doors without any open discussion of that. And that, to my mind, was not appropriate. And if anyone had the legal muscle or the time and energy, it should be challenged in court. Again, as I said, what we're really going to be listening to here is Mark Premack's response to Mayor Fitzmaurice, who's, come on, hurry up, is similar to what Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin and Cynthia Matthews and all these old council members, the old bad gang, remember those boys and girls, the people who wanted to bulldoze everything in the beach flats and give everything over to the Seaside Company, they were saying the same thing in 1998. Come on, come on, we've waited too long. Rush, rush, rush. Let's roll. The same line is now being promulgated by Fitzmaurice and the new City Council. I'm not going to say go figure because I think I figured, and unfortunately what I figure is what I thought we were going to get and what we got. Let's hear more of this this final discussion where Premack is the dissenter. City Council meeting today on the Dolphin Lee.
Community center, we want all those things.
Still
do it in
Morris.
Any way that makes sense for this community, but do it. And what we're essentially doing here is filling out the legal paperwork on the replacement housing plan and on the relocation plan. We're saying we're initiating that flow of events. We're not foreclosing all other possibilities of streets and things like that, but we are announcing a particular project in a particularly legal way, and I think we need to do that. I'm very much in support of the motion. I'm in support of doing it right now. There'll be plenty of public opportunities for the public to come. Many were here. The people that are interested in this project are here and spoke, and they've spoken many other times. I'm hoping that we
still
can actually vote positively on this particular motion. Kennedy.
Yeah, I wondered if the maker of the motion would be open to an amendment, which I think just strengthens in the spirit of what the mayor has just stated, that the direction further include that staff would actively cooperate with Mercy to bring items to the council in a timely manner so that we can meet the aggressive time frame that was thought out this afternoon.
Is that necessary?
Maybe
I have some inputs in the motion.
Within our staff limitations,
I think it's good.
The question, and then a comment. The question of Gene or Seal.
This is Mark Premack speaking.
It's my understanding that there are some other housing projects that are being floated or presented to council members and planners. I haven't seen them that involve a certain number of low-cost, low-income, and very low-income units. Could those projects serve as replacement units for the tenants at Dolphin Lane?
It would depend upon timing. If the tenants were interested. Generally, you want.
This is Cecile Cirillo, who's been pushing this plan as the head of the redevelopment agency, with a salary of over $100,000 a year for the last two or three years. She's been pushing this plan.
Let's talk about those elements. Is there housing in the neighborhood in which they are currently living, where their children go to school, where all of their services are? One of those developments that you referred to is not in that immediate area.
Right.
Certainly, if the level of affordability is as is being expressed, the tenants moving out of the beach flats area would qualify to move into those units.
So if there were a project that were happening more quickly, say, than this project is happening.
Right. It would be a relocation.
It would be a relocation.
We've also talked with the developer of 155 Chestnut Street as a potential for temporary relocation if we needed that.
Right. I'm the designated bad guy in this situation, and I've made my feelings about this known to council members in closed session and to other people who have talked to me in the community. I just want to say that I'm very grateful that there is affordable housing in Santa Cruz. My son's buddies live in Nears Lagoon, and I am very happy that they and their families have safe, clean housing in this city. And I would like to see much more of it in the city of Santa Cruz. We need to see much more of it in the city of Santa Cruz. And my objection to this project is that, unlike the placard that was up on the back wall that said more affordable housing, this represents far less affordable housing than the city could achieve in the next 5 and 10 years. Far less than it could achieve. We could pursue quickly other avenues for creating housing that would give us 4 times the number of units in the city in the next 5 years than this project will create. And what that says is for every unit that's built, the Dolphin Lee Rex Court project, for every lucky family that moves in, there are going to be 3 other families in the beach flats who are going to be dispossessed and forced to leave the area because we've made this choice. And that is the part that I can't condone and I can't support. It's the knowledge that we could do this better, that we could house more people in the same period of time, and then choose not to do it, is what I cannot support. The numbers that we have here are they're fictitious numbers, absolutely fictitious numbers. The comparison with the Chestnut Street project is, I have to say it, it's ludicrous. We cancel out the low acquisition costs for the Chestnut Street project and the high acquisition costs for the Dolphin Lee. We cancel out the 0 relocation costs for the Chestnut Street project and the high relocation costs for the Dolphin Lee. And then we start working towards some sort of equity. We don't acknowledge the fact that the Chestnut Street project is providing 96 kitchens and 96 bathrooms, which are the most expensive part of construction.
And here you see the point-by-point demolition of the Elizabeth Vogel figures that were put before the City Council that were supposedly showed that Mercy Charity's housing was just as cheap as the... let's say, the Chestnut Street project, which was done with private funding and was privately developed. He just demolishes it, just stat by stat. And the point here is not so much that he's right on this issue, is that there is just complete loss of credibility of Elizabeth Vogel of Mercy Charities Housing has been pushing this project, and of the entire city council, which has no response to this destruction of the credibility of Vogel, other than to simply say, just keep repeating what they said before, it's still good affordable housing, we need it anyway, and so forth. So it's just remarkable the kind of direct confrontation that Premack is doing here, showing that, in his view, if Elizabeth Vogel isn't lying, she's incompetent, and she's presenting figures that are false. Let's hear some more of Councilmember Premack talking about the Dolphin Lee Project.
Twice as many as this project is, and we cook the numbers down to the point where we say, according to the contractor's estimates for Chestnut Street and the projected cost of Beach Flats, they're about the same. And the architect is surprised that they're about the same, and I'm equally surprised they're about the same. And it begs the question, what will this project actually cost when it's built? And what we know is that it's going to cost more, just based on the numbers we have been presented here, it's going to cost more than what we have been led to believe. And that is why I can't support this project, because I feel that we have to do everything we can to house as many people as we can in this city. And this project, I think the new housing staff person in her misstatement said it correctly. This is a history. This is a lot of history with a project attached to it. And that history is not part of my experience on council. It's not part of efforts I have made to create affordable housing in the city of Santa Cruz. And I don't feel that I am chained to that history. I feel that we have 5 years of projected housing money, and we have to spend it as wisely as we can. And we can do it, we can act quickly, and we can create, seriously, 200 units in the next 5 years of low and very low housing that's integrated into market rate housing throughout the city that integrates people in the community. I have fought for the last 15 years against.
And that was Councilmember Premack. And as we're turning over the tape to hear the last of his speech, plus the feeble rejoinders of members on the council who continue to support the project, and they are by far the majority, 6-1, the progressive cheering gallery for Mercy Charities Housing. Here we go.
So that the applications that you considered or heard about this year, such as the Women's Health Center renovation, such as any further needs of the Familiar Center, things like that, these could not be funded, because if you assume that all these funds are available here.
Well, actually, that's not the right voice, and for some reason we aren't getting the final words of Premack. That's actually Gene Arner, their staff member. But you catch his drift. And for those who want to actually see this video, for those of you who were involved in the Dolphin Lee Forum that we held last fall in a kind of a vain attempt to continue to bring the issue to the community's attention, Becky Johnson has videoed the entire thing this afternoon, and hopefully that video will also be available. Give a call to 423-HUFF if you're interested, 423-4833. I know that for some folks who are just tuning in, this is all kind of, you know, wow, what's going on here? And it's essentially the fact that the city is going to spend $16.5 million, all its affordable housing money for the next 5 years, to destroy existing affordable housing, give it to a nonprofit called Mercy Charities Housing, which is its sole source monopoly housing provider in the city, to build a favored project that they've been wanting to build for 5 or 6 years, actually longer than that, 7 or 8 years, and in the Beach Flats, which is a subsidized housing project. Nothing wrong with housing projects. Nothing wrong necessarily with Mercy Charities per se. But the whole process is not to consider building on vacant property, which would be cheaper, and not to consider building on vacant property, which would allow existing housing to remain and possibly be refurbished. No, instead, and my main concern has been, the tenants are going to be put in a position where they're either going to be bought off and told to leave with a sum of money they can't possibly pay for the kinds of low rents they had before, so they'll have to leave town. They're going to be offered $5,250, and they're saying to the tenants, "Well, gee, you pull some money together and buy a house." Well, you know, maybe in Tijuana somewhere, I don't know. I don't think here any certainly not in Santa Cruz, and probably not anywhere on the coast, and you know, maybe somewhere else. I suppose, you know, it might be considered a better deal to some extent, but it's not fair to destroy existing housing and force people to move because you want to cater to a Mercy Charities housing notion of what is good for folks down there. And some of the council members made much of the fact that they had gone down and talked to the people in the project, and they were, I should say, in the current housing, and they were satisfied. That included Christopher Crone and Ed Porter. Ed Porter said that the idea of demanding guarantees was a red herring. I don't think it's a red herring at all, and it seems to me kind of the most elementary place you start. Scan thought so, and so did the Green Party, but apparently the city council couldn't have cared less or agreed less. So if you want to ask questions of the city council about any of these issues, why did you vote for this project without guarantees? 420-5017 is the city council phone number. 420-5017. Our phone number is 427-3772. 427-3772. Now, I have a guest in the studio with me today who has brought along some nice pictures that I'm looking at right now. And you may be aware of the Stone Man, or is he Rock Man?
Stuart Finch, the Rock Man.
That's not the man we have in the studio. In the studio with us is, well, how would you like to identify yourself?
My name is Steve Elliott. I'm the protege of the famous Rock Man.
You are, in fact, merely an apprentice at his knee, so to speak.
Yes.
So, Steve, you got some nice pictures of kind of rocks piled up and sort of
sculptures.
Sculptures on, and they're balanced. I guess where does this happen down on the?
It's down on Westcliff, right by the lighthouse.
And how long has Rock Man and have you been doing this?
Rockman had been doing it for 20 years, and I befriended him about June, and I've been doing it about middle of June of last year.
Now, you've been homeless since that time, or what's your living situation been like?
In June, I was living with my sister, and in July, I became homeless.
And so you've been homeless since July.
Yeah, a long time.
And you've had an opportunity to sample the fine social services of our city.
Yes, fine.
In fact, Steve,
you have to forgive me.
Yeah. I'm having a few bites here on the air. I hope you folks aren't too offended by my taking dinner as I actually lunch. Well, I'm going to try to clean up my act here. I actually met you, Steve, on Sunday for the first time. Apparently you'd abandoned or you'd left your earlier venue out on the Westcliff, where you were working with Rockman to do these sculptures. You actually came downtown, and you were sitting with a sign, hungry, homeless. What did your sign say?
It said, "Hungry, homeless, anything helps."
And you came into the studio today, and you were still hungry, and you were still homeless, I know.
Yeah,
because
I grabbed at that stuff like no tomorrow.
He's been chomping down on the corn nuts, man. we got to do something about this guy. So, but
like
you've been
a rat.
You've been well, yeah. You've been using the homeless services since July. Give me some thoughts about what's it like to be homeless in Santa Cruz, and what does it mean for you? I mean, you, and how does it happen?
It means you just feel crummy day after day. You just have to get up and survive, and you have to go to different places to get your food if you're broke, which I am. Most people are one check from being homeless, and it's nothing to look forward to. It's not a fun life out there, and you just keep getting tired and more tired until you just can't stand it anymore. And then you listen to all the other people around you, and most of them are pretty off the wall, and pretty soon you start feeling kind of nuts like them. And if you're not nuts, it drives you nuts. So,
what kind of work were you doing before you entered this homeless condition?
Oh, shoot, I've been a cabinet maker. I worked with sheet metal. I was a repairman of printing machines and electronic devices. I got an A in electronics to repair computers, I worked in restaurants. I was a roofer. I was a printer for 10 years. I've done another number of things. I know how to repair cars, and I've done a lot of stuff in my life. It's just at this point, I'm disabled somewhat.
What kind of disability do you got?
Oh, I was hit by a drunk driver in 1980, and he was doing about 60, and he rear-ended me. And 2 years later, in 1982, I just get a settlement from that, and I went to Lake Tahoe, and I got hit head-on by another drunk driver, and they let him go.
Are they all related, perhaps?
Could be.
Mm-hmm. Seems that
way. I think once they hit the bottle, they're all related. And then I took a fall off of a roof onto my back, and then my mother was dying of cancer, and I was taken to the hospital, and she was getting out of the car onto her walker. I was helping her up, and she took a fall, and I grabbed her, and I broke my ribs. So I've been suffering with broken ribs and a sciatic and lower back pain, neck pains, shoulder pains.
And every night you sleep on the ground? Or
I sleep in the back seat of my car at the moment.
So you're an illegal car sleeper. Do you think we should call the police on you and get you taken in?
If it'll give you 3 square meals.
Have you been arrested while you've been in Santa Cruz?
I haven't been arrested since I was a minor for runaway and things like that, you know, just minor stuff when I was younger, back in the 60s, of course.
And yet, I guess, the other day on the mall, you had brought some of these rock sculptures to the front of Logos Bookshop, where you were actually not in the bookshop, you were on the sidewalk, well away from the front of the building, but you had created a few small rock sculptures?
Yeah, well, it started out when I was sitting in front of a soap shop. I was looking for a spot that I could sit that wouldn't bother anybody else because there's all these different people who they have their little spots. And I found a spot that I thought would be right. And I noticed that everybody would look, you know, all around. But as soon as I pulled my sign out, they started noticing all the soap in the store. And I was giving that lady a big advertisement. You know, I mean, nobody wants to look at you.
They
know?
Looked at the... at the store window, but anything but look at you and your sign, huh?
Yeah, so...
Did you think of charging the store for
yeah,
diverting
I
their attention?
Did. I was just, you know, I'm kind of a jokey kind of guy, and I was going to go in there and tell her, I'll sit out here and have people look into your store, and for $10, I'll sit here all day for you.
It's actually illegal to sit within 10 feet of a store window unless you're on a chair. Strange kind of law, but it's the sitting ban. It was passed in 1994 by Scott Kennedy, of all people. He still, I assume, supports the law because he immediately, once it was thrown out by the courts when it was in a more broad form, he moved to pass it again in the summer of 1994. That's one of our current city council members. But go ahead, Steve. You had some rock sculptures you'd set up and
yeah, I went down to the river and I
today,
picked up
yesterday or
it was on the 17th. I picked up down at the river. I just picked up some unusual looking rocks that have points and things like that, an unusual look. About the size of my fist or a little bit bigger. And I put them in a little bag, you know, one of these little clothing bags, and I hauled them down there on my bike. And we had done it once before, the Rock Man and I, and tried to sell my photographs that I'm showing you here. But
nice-looking photographs, by the way.
They wouldn't let us sell the photographs. They're like little gift cards. And so, but they said, just, you know, keep back and don't bother anybody. So I assumed it was okay. So I set up about 5 little sculptures about 12 inches high, and they're just slightly separated so when they fall, you know, because it was windy, that they wouldn't knock them all down in like a domino effect. And then I proceeded to sit on the ground, but I have a sciatic, and it started...
You mean
to
on hurt. on the pavement?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I sat there...
In front of Logos Books near the curb.
Yeah, and I didn't know there was a any kind of, a, you know, just...
Sitting band,
yeah,
you know,
or whatever it is,
stores,
you know, blocking the sidewalk, which is, if you're... Anybody comes through there, there's no crosswalk. You'd have to be jaywalking in the first
Actually,
place.
Actually, a sitting band does not include sitting near the sidewalk, a curb. It only has to do with 10 feet in front of a store window or entranceway.
Yeah, so I parked my bike and locked it up on the trash can, which was no problem because nobody was coming that way because it's just the spot. If you knew where it was, it's no problem. And then after a while, my legs were hurting, so I had to get up, and I stood around for a few minutes, and then I went to sit down. Then the police came by the second time, and then because I was sitting on the bench, because I had my rocks, and because I had my bike, I was impeding the flow of the curb, which is not true, because, you know, I've studied that corner for the last day now, and there's nobody comes across there. They just wanted to harass me, because I'd been standing around with a sign for a couple days in town. I'm mm-hmm. desperate.
And
so I got ridden up.
This was Officer RoboCop Perry, a black, bald-headed officer who did this to you?
Yeah, I don't know why they call him RoboCop. He was always friendly whenever I said hello, but that day he was just, you know, just talking down to me like I, you know, was some kind of a criminal or, you know, carrying a gun or something like that. Like, you know, he was ready to. And I tried to ask him, well, what are you going to cite me for? Because he pulled out his ticket book, and then he goes, don't make me mad now. I says, all I'm trying to do is find out the facts. You know, I'm 46 years old. I'm not a young kid to be pushed around. I mean, I've been through the mill, and I don't need to be pushed around by the cops. I mean, I was civil. I'm friendly. I'm well-dressed, or at least as well-dressed as you can be without taking a shower for a week.
Better dressed than I am, I might add, which I resent, of course.
But, you know, and he had his other partner there, and they had taken a report. His other partner took a report, and it almost seemed like he did the same thing to me. Like, he didn't care whether my bike was ripped off out of the bike mall area down here in the bus station area. I mean, there's constant rip-offs down there. I mean,
you mean you had actually lost a bike, or what?
Yeah, I only went around the corner for 5 minutes, came back, and it was gone. And then I found it down in the mall with
somebody else's locker. This was an earlier incident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I reported it, and then when I found it, you know, with somebody else's lock on it, I called them and told them, you don't have to look for my bike anymore, but it's locked up, and I don't have any way of getting it off. And they says, well, tough luck, you know. So I really didn't, they didn't really recover it for me. I recovered it.
How did you get it back?
I put a note on it saying that you just stole from a poor guy, and if you'd asked me, I'd have given it to you. And I gave him about a half a day to, you know, go down there and take his lock off, and then they ended up jamming my lock with something in it, you know, because I put my strap around it. As soon as I saw it, I put my lock, my extra lock around it. And next thing I know, I go down there, and I just took a pair of pliers and a little sledgehammer I had in my trunk, and I just whacked it one time, and those things are cheap.
So they didn't respond to your appeal. They just left their
lock. I just tied the guy's lock on there, which it eventually disappeared, but I just took the bike down and relocked it up. And as soon as I locked it up, a friend of mine that has a little bike tent, I gave it to him. Mm-hmm. I just didn't like the idea that there's somebody out there creeping around ripping me off. So I'd give it to him if he asked for it. You know, I'm a warm-hearted person. I just don't like to be chumped.
And the police, for the purposes of this story, didn't. I mean, that's what we're interested in. They didn't respond when you tried to file a report of a stolen bike?
I just responded enough to where they just came down and took a report, and he really wasn't concerned. So, I mean, both those guys... You know, I'm a marked man down there now, because now if I pay that ticket...
$81?
Yeah, $81 went down to the municipal building, and it's $81, and I don't have $81. Why am I getting $81? Like, standing out there holding a sign, and they're going to expect me to pay for it. I mean, they could have given me... I went down to the library today, and I looked up some of the charge I was charged with, but then I kept reading, and they were supposed to give me some kind of a warning so that I would move on instead of just giving me a ticket, you know, because I was using the seat because I'm disabled, because I had to sit down. I was sitting on the bench when he added all these up to about, you know, that I was blocking the area. But, you know, everybody down there has a right to use all that stuff, you know, and I have a right to park my bike. So the only thing I was really doing was just add the rocks.
Did you say anybody had complained?
Nobody complained. In fact, everybody that came by loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had.
So he didn't, and he didn't give you a warning either, saying this is illegitimate.
Okay,
you have
how
to
it
move
started
on.
Out, when I first set him up, I was worried. Because I, you know, I hadn't done it before, and I needed something so people look at my sign, because I, you know, I'm desperate. Mm-hmm. So here I am sitting here, and the first cop comes by. He has these little short pants on, the glasses, like they all look, you know, and he jumps on me and, what's this? You know, and I have my cup out a little ways out from the rocks towards on the sidewalk, and he goes, what are you selling here? And I go, I'm not selling anything. He goes, you're selling these things here? And I says, I'm not selling any rocks. I'm just displaying them. It's an art. You know, it's an art sculpture. I wanted him to look at my sign. What's the sign? I says, well, I'm hungry, and I'm trying to get something to eat. And he goes, what's the cup for? It looks like you're trying to sell something. And I says, I'm not trying to sell anything. Anybody thinks I'm going to sell these rocks, they got rocks in their head, you know. So here I am. So he goes, well, let me tell you what you're going to do about that. And he picks up my cup, and he puts it on the other side of the rocks. And he says, okay, now just keep it back there. And then he walked off. Then about 15, 20 minutes later, the two women policemen walked through. And they look over, and they smile, because, you know, they were the ones that talked to us before, the rock band and I, one of them. So they walked through. Then... The black officer and the white officer come through. They looked at it, and then they left, because I saw them. And then later on, about an hour later, they came back without any warning and just walked up to me and, what are you bringing your rocks into the town for? You know, what do you got all this stuff here for? You know, and you know you're not supposed to bring in that stuff into town. I says, I'm just trying to bring some art and some beauty and some recognition to my sign, and I'm not selling anything like that. And next thing I know, out comes the ticket book, and I said, what are you citing me for? And you know the rest.
I believe at one point you also said that you said, I can't sing, I can't dance.
Yeah,
so.
I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't do any of that stuff. I can't play guitar. I can play a synthesizer, but they won't let you plug it in there. Everybody else gets a chance to play their music, but the guys that have any kind of amplified music, you're cut out, you know, you're discriminated against. I can play a mean synthesizer. I have about six albums of music that I've been playing since my dad died. He used to go to Juilliard Arts, and I just picked it up naturally in my soul. Before I was born, he went to Juilliard, so I have a talent. So I made all this really neat sounding music, and, you know, I would like to come down and play it and let people hear it, but there's no way I can do that. So all I knew was rocks. I know a lot of talents, but I mean, the only thing I can actually make is a little thing. Like, everybody has a little thing down there.
But you've been interested in rocks considerably, because you've been doing this since last July, right?
Yeah. Some of those pictures, a lot of those are mine.
Have you gotten better at it, you think?
A lot better. Mm-hmm. I got so good that Rockman doesn't want me coming around, because
really?
I'm telling you, he's jealous. He doesn't like me not around here anymore.
Now, is this yours?
I built that one. Yes, I did.
That is very nice. This looks like...
I remember building it. I can remember right now the day I did that.
Ratman's, what we call it, his chess sculptures. Ratman does chess sculptures. And he can put, he's had a 64-piece sculpture all balanced on one piece of these chess pieces. It's just amazing.
You just got to know the trick and have patience is all it is.
I guess so.
Yep.
My advice to you, of course, as far as this ticket goes, is to challenge it. And the way to challenge it is first... wait a week or two, because it won't appear in court until then. Then go to the basement of the county building, and I encourage other people to do the same. Whenever you get a ticket, make sure you disqualify referee Mulligan. He's the first person who would normally go to in Department 10. And the way to do that is you say, I want to disqualify Mulligan, because otherwise he will be the man you'll get. And I want to send it into another court.
Is he like he's a mean judge? Somebody told me the morning judge is better.
He is simply, he's not a judge, he's a referee, and he's simply a man who grinds out fines for the city. I mean, that's his job.
Real justice, that's what I call it.
I mean, he'll sound very nice to you. And frankly, there's some disagreement. I activist Richard Quigley and I had a conversation about this yesterday or the day before. He swears by Mulligan. I swear at Mulligan. So we have a difference of opinion. But I've generally found Mulligan is prejudiced against poor people, that he's very harsh. Quigley says, all these judges are harsh, it's the court system, but Mulligan's a nice guy because I've talked to him. He has a good relationship with Mulligan, and if you have a good relationship with a judge, that's fine, or a referee posing as a judge, wearing black robes. It's the lowest kind of judge in the sense of, you know, they have referees, and they have commissioners, and they have judges at the top of that chain. But what you should do is go to the clerk in the basement of the county building and say, I'd like to... this is my ticket, or this is my name with the ticket on it, and I would like to disqualify referee Mulligan. They'll say, okay, well, then you can put it in another court, and they'll give you, it actually goes automatically to another court.
Great.
You have to appear there for an arraignment. You then go to the arraignment probably a week later, plead not guilty, and the week after that, you get a court trial. You don't get a jury trial, of course, because it's just an infraction. You don't get an attorney appointed for you because it's just...
$81 infraction.
What's that?
An $81 infraction.
It is an $81 infraction. But however, by this time, particularly if you get some media around it, I understand you had a conversation with the Metro reporter today.
Yeah, I talked to the Metro woman.
And it's April 22nd, 2001, around 10 o'clock in the morning. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, hello. Okay, we're on, we're speaking publicly now, and it's at the police community room, and we're going to have a conference on Title IV, and I'm going to be recording this for public use.
Are folks,
I'll just sit here, Eric, if that's the case. You're going to be difficult about it. Eric has said he doesn't want the tape recorder near the lectern. I'm not sure why that would be, because otherwise you won't get a clear recording.
Okay, folks, if we could, let's have a seat. We'll go ahead and get started here. First of all, my name is Steve Belcher. I'm the chief of police. We are not hosting this meeting. It just happens to be at the community room of the police department. So if you haven't been here at the police department before, the community room, we want to welcome you. What we're going to talk about tonight is really... The Resource Center for Nonviolence is really the host of this meeting tonight. Eric Morris, I'll be introducing in just a moment. But I really want to thank you for being here. These issues are near and dear to us. We try to work in cooperative spirit with all different segments of the community about all these different issues. What you'll be hearing tonight is talking about neighborhood issues, and neighborhood issues is really what makes up the community. So when we look at the bigger community, it's made up of individual neighborhoods. So what we're hoping tonight is for you folks to be better informed about your own community, how we, the bigger we, can work together, whether it's your neighbors and neighbors, neighbors and government, neighbors and private business, whatever it might be, how we can all put it together and work closer together. So with that, again, thanks very much for being here. A little housekeeping items if we can. If you need to go to the bathroom is just in the door on the right-hand side. The other door is locked, so make sure you go to the one just on the inside to the right. Anyway, get anything else, Jim?
No, this is pretty much it. If you have decaf, regular coffee, cookies, anything else, let us know.
Officer Jim Howes will be here during the meeting, so if you have any questions about things like that, he'll be available. At this time, I'd like to introduce Eric Larson. Eric, in his...
Some more people have arrived. Tony Madrigal and Tamara, and possibly four residents from the Beach South of Laurel neighborhood. The translation material is set up. We have a crew of about 10, 20, 25 or 30 people. Officer Jim Howes, Chief Belcher, Scott Kennedy, Keith Sugar. There are chairs set up in the back, and then there's a kind of a horseshoe-shaped table. And again, it's about 7:20 in the evening on April 25th, and Eric is about to begin his presentation. And it looks like we have a couple more residents possibly showing up, and there's still a couple seats free. So earlier Eric asked me to move to the back of the room. I said if that was necessary, I'd be happy to do so. And, boy, there's still some more folks coming. I'm going to leave this here. From this perspective, I just want to be able to get a good photo. I'm going to give it back to you. So, I hate it. Please. I want to get a good recording. This is a bummer. So, we have some more residents.
Hay asientos aquí.
So we're still recording. There's some more folks who are coming to have a seat. And I'm just kind of waiting for the whole process to begin. And it looks like the residents are making up a majority of the people at the table. Are people of certainly Hispanic skin color. Linda LeMaster is here. Chief Belcher continues.
Chief of Police, I want to welcome you to the Santa Cruz Police Department, and I want to thank you for being here tonight. This is really about neighbors helping neighbors, working together, like I say, be it private citizens, government, and business, whatever it might be. It's really to make your neighborhoods a better place to live and to work. And with that, we did a training similar to this about 7 or 8 years ago, that's my recollection, and it worked out real well. And Eric Larson, who I'll introduce in just a moment, was one of the original participants of that, and was really involved in some of the formation of NOLO, the Neighbors of Lower Ocean Street, along with Scott and several other people, GD back in the back. And we've kind of kept this group together over the years. I think they do super work. And with that, I want to introduce Eric Larson, who works for
EMT.
Well, I'll let Eric explain it. So thank you very much, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and welcome, everyone. It's a really good showing here tonight. My name is Eric Larson, and I'm a consultant with EMT. which is evaluation management training. We have a state contract to provide alcohol and other drug prevention services statewide, and tonight's event here is being sponsored by the Resource Center for Nonviolence, Neighbors of Lower Ocean, Caton, Kids and Teens Enjoying Nature, the Santa Cruz Police Department, and the Neighborhood Services Team of the City of Santa Cruz. They are sponsoring the training tonight and have asked me to provide you some training on how to make your neighborhoods a safer place to live. And kind of as a kind of a side note on this training, it's also a way to hold landlords and property owners accountable for the mismanagement of their properties. Just a little bit about myself is that I'm a former staff member with the Resource Center for Nonviolence and have worked for the last 5 years or so and have lived in the Lower Ocean Street neighborhood and have seen my share of drug dealing and gang activity, loitering, graffiti. Just on the block over where I live, there was a drive-by shooting a year ago where 3 young men were killed. And so kind of neighborhood safety is something that I'm really concerned about. And I know that many of the people here tonight are very concerned about as well. We have neighbors from Beach Flats neighborhood. We have neighbors from Lower Ocean Street neighborhood. Two areas that are impacted by alcohol and drugs, violence, and other what I'm going to term nuisance issues or nuisance activities. So without much further ado, I'm going to kind of go through the training here, and we have kind of a little presentation here that I'm going to give. I'm just going to walk you through what it means to hold a property owner accountable for nuisance activities and what it means to hold a property owner accountable for their mismanagement of their property. So what we're going to do is we're going to explore a little bit about legal theory, how to do a small claims court case, success stories, and then we'll also have room for discussion and some dialogue. If folks have questions as we go, that's appropriate. Please raise your hand, and if you have a certain question or you don't quite understand some wording, or if maybe the translation is maybe...
There's a pause while the translator apparently has mislaid the antenna, is consulting with the various Spanish-speaking people to see if they're hearing the translation properly. On the screen is a slide, Neighbors Training for Action, Learn How to Use Property Law to Increase Neighborhood Safety. Legal Theory, How to Begin a Small Claims Case, Success Stories, and finally, Discussion. Process is going to be people can interrupt with questions. And again, they're still working on making the translation equipment accessible to folks who speak Spanish. There are about 15 people in the seats in the back. Again, this is run by NOLO, which is a neighborhood, Lower Ocean, something like that, NOLO 2. And there's still... We're talking about simultaneous translation now, possibly doing that instead of, or subsequent translation, because they're having problems with the antenna, which apparently is not included in the equipment. We have a number of children are here too, a number of women who seem, by their skin color, if we're to be judging simply on that, are members of the Beach Flats area. Tony Guerrero, formerly of the Citizens Police Review Board, is here, protege of Scott Kennedy. Scott is sitting next to Tony Madrigal, and Keith Sugar is smoozing with Chief Belcher, who is in a business suit, Belcher that is. And we'll be continuing with the English translation in a moment. Eric Larson begins again.
What we're going to learn about is how to increase neighborhood safety. by using property law.
The law states that a property owner must use his or her property in an ordinary and reasonable manner that is conducive to the peace and harmony of the neighborhood and does not interfere with the comfortable enjoyment of life or property. That's the law. That's what the state of California real estate law says. Now, if a nuisance exists on or around a property, then neighbors may seek legal recourse and sue a property owner for emotional or mental distress. You can sue a property owner in small claims court for loss of enjoyment of life. And probably the best deal is if we can clump people together in one area here.
So we're exchanging seats to make sure that the folks who speak Spanish are going to have an opportunity to be up here for the training, and that's seems fair enough.
Full manner that's
distributed some paper for folks.
Of a neighborhood, and does not interfere with the comfortable enjoyment of life or property. Again, that's the law. So if a nuisance exists on or around a property, neighbors may seek legal recourse and sue a property owner in small claims court. And you can sue for emotional or mental distress. You can sue a property owner in small claims court for loss of enjoyment of life. That's if a nuisance exists. And a nuisance is defined as anything that is injurious to your health, indecent to the senses, obstructs the free use of sidewalks or the streets, obstructs the free use of property so as to interfere with the comfortable enjoyment of life. Now, emotional and mental distress is, what is that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, oftentimes, as you know, kind of a nuisance will cause certain emotional and mental reactions. And that's what you're going to sue for in terms of damages in a small claims court case. And emotional and mental reactions include fright, horror, grief, shame, humiliation, anger, anxiety, disappointment. You know, I know some examples of this is, you know, if you're walking home from the market, and you've got a group of guys who are always asking you, you know, if you want to buy something. Or they say certain things like, hey, baby, you know, they're kind of whistling at you. Or, you know, you feel fearful going to the market or being in your house. Or you've got a group of 5 or 10 people hanging out on your doorstep drinking beer. Or just passing all night long, gambling and sidewalk. These are all things that kind of can cause certain reactions, you know, of fear, of anxiety. And that's emotional, mental distress. The California State Supreme Court has upheld nuisance claims, and in which a group of neighbors have consolidated small claims court cases, an individual can sue for up to $5,000 in small claims court. They can sue for, again, the mismanagement of the property that is causing you emotional and mental distress. And some neighborhood groups have actually won judgments of up to $100,000. And when you have this kind of lawsuit or amount of damages hanging over someone's head, that's a lot to kind of get a, kind of landlord's attention. But, JD.
Focusing attendance is not to make money, but to improve your living situation.
Before you get your hopes up about... So before you get your hopes up about kind of getting rich off of some landlord who's, not taking care of their property, whether it's a landlord at 204 Riverside or a landlord on Raymond Street or on Bixby Street or wherever, really the idea of this kind of small claims court strategy is to get the attention of a property owner so that they can make changes on the property and clean things up, so that you can live a life without drugs, without gangs on your doorstep, without crime, without housing code violations, without things that are affecting your quality of life. Ninety percent of the time in these kinds of small claims court cases, after a property owner has been notified that there's a problem, 90% of the time they're going to clean things up. And they're going to take necessary steps to, make sure that a nuisance doesn't exist and to improve your quality of life. 5% of the time, property owners won't take any kind of action until you filed in small claims court or until you've actually sent a demand letter and have stated that we're going to take you to court if you don't clean things up. Or some landlords, if you have a TV camera going to their place of business or going to their church or a place where they kind of frequent, that's something that you can use to get their attention. Another 5% of property owners aren't going to do anything, no matter what the police department says, no matter what a city council member says, no matter what you say. They really don't care. They've got their property, a rental property, and they're just there to make money off the neighbors and tenants that are suffering from nuisance activities in their neighborhood. So it's kind of this 5% that really this kind of this small claims court strategy is really focused on. I don't know if this is kind of the right strategy for your neighborhood. I don't know if there are properties in your neighborhood that have problems that could use some kind of special attention through this small claims court process. Or maybe you're wondering, how do you start a small claims case? Or I don't know if this is something that interests neighbors. What I kind of like to do is, yeah. It could be your landlord, or it could be your neighbors. And, maybe a question I have for folks right now is, what kind of problems do you have in your neighborhood? And is this something that might work for you? Sure. Okay.
She's on section eight. She got notice from the housing authority. that she was going to be evicted within 30 days. Where are you going to live if you put in the suit? A lot of power landlords have for low-income people. We don't have the funds to be running to court and spending all this money.
That's really true, is that tenants, people that live kind of in an apartment complex, you oftentimes feel powerless about, you know, if you make a complaint about fixing the sink or electricity, or feel powerless that, yeah, your rents are going sky high, and, you know, what can you really do about it? Oftentimes these small claims court cases, really the real benefit is if neighbors surrounding your property can get involved in a small claims case in which you can play a key part in documenting nuisance activity. You may not, because of fear of your landlord or being evicted, you may not want to be a claimant. But you can help your neighbors document stuff that's going on with property, and your neighbors can be the folks that will advocate for you and be a claimant in a case. Yeah, exactly.
And they've done a wonderful job. That can happen.
Once you send that demand letter, you know, you send a notice to the property owner to clean things up. Sometimes that's all it really takes to get, action. But what I'd like to maybe ask is maybe Jose or Josefina, you can maybe talk a little bit about what's going on 15th Street and what kind of what are you facing on kind of Bixby? And maybe Laura, you can maybe help out a little bit.
Well, we've got a very serious problem on Bixby Street. We've got a lot of gowns. You know, we've got a lot of people who are hanging around doing drugs, prostitution. I mean, it's like, you know, they're gambling outside. It's very bad. We really, you know. And then we have a year. Yeah, it was a year ago. You know, those three guys were shooting and killing, that street. It's about, three blocks from, three houses from my house. So it's like, you're afraid to go outside at nighttime. Mm-hmm. You are before, about 3 or 4 years ago, we make, a community get together and we're just going to clean it up the street. But it seems to me like those people they went to jail and now they're out, so they went back where they were. So I'm exactly, but I think we have to get together again.
There's kind of people that keep coming back.
Yes, they're coming back.
Do they keep coming back to a certain property or a certain area?
Well, yeah, they come into the same area, it looks to me, and then, they are like, before, they always have, we have, some undercover cops and stuff like that coming, to get to get those people who was, drug dealers. And, I haven't seen, happen that right now at this time, at this point. And people are, can I get afraid, because what happened, we got even experience. Eric and we we got a meeting with the police, and it since happened when we was going into the house where we're going to have the meeting. The police arrived, so they shake our hands, and then in about 3 days, my car, window was broke. And then about 2 days later, Eric's car windows was broke. So people get afraid to call the police or whatever, because they take, over them. So it's like...
Maybe Laura, you can kind of help out too, kind of what's going on, what your experience on Bixby Street is.
Well, it's just, I mean, what I see a lot of is same thing, the gangs and hanging out, public drinking, gambling. I haven't seen much of the prostitution myself, but I see a lot of the gang stuff. And I see that although my voice is so loud, it's probably using my gun, but kind of scary.
Anyway, so there's gambling, drinking, hanging out, staring you down. And, you know, I know that Josefina also has kids, and there's a lot of fear around letting my kids play outside, which is not good when it's the street where you're raising the kids. So my main thing is that I want my neighborhood to be a place where I feel safe letting my kids play outside, because there's a lot of great kids that live on that street. Like, I would love for my kids to play more with Josefina's kids, but in between my house and her house is that gang, and I don't feel comfortable just letting my kids, you know, walk down there. But if they weren't there, they might be hanging out more on the street. So
I kind of like to have drawn a little bit of a map here of Bixby Street. Maybe get a marker. Is there a certain area on Bixby Street that you can identify where a lot of this stuff is happening?
Yeah, you want me to come to
that?
Okay. The other thing that happened was about 5 days ago, the whole neighborhood got tagged big time, and everywhere. And so it's not fun.
3 days ago, everything got tagged, she says.
Okay, you know, graffiti with there with the gang sign with MS-13 everywhere.
So, and then Laura comes up to the map, which Eric has drawn. She's locating the place that she regards the particular problems.
25 and 120 and this is where they hang, and this is right where the boys got shot, right here is where the boys got shot, and this is where these guys hang on the sidewalk playing, and so, oops, sorry.
So, I mean, there's, like, on Bixby Street, there's a certain place that we can identify that there's a problem. So the question is, why is it that on this certain spot in this particular street, there continues to be ongoing problems of drinking, gang activity, whatever? This sort of activity you can attach to the owner for actually not maintaining their property. This is kind of a target of how you can kind of use small claims court, put pressure on the property owner to actually fix things up. Maybe I could ask someone from the Beach Flats area to maybe come up and draw a little bit on them.
Can I get you to help? Can you use that for people insurance?
And maybe if someone might be interested from just drawing something from their own street, from another area, whether it's someone else would be interested, maybe Tony, would you be interested in coming up?
Actually, I just had a suggestion. If you draw, say, swimming streets, Riverside, all right, have folks just come in, pinpoint where they can be set.
All right,
that might be helpful.
Now a second drawing is being made on a second
bulletin board in green chalk. Again, the idea being to involve tenants to come up and discuss where they see problems on the sidewalk. Questions I would ask, of course, which I haven't asked, have to do with police. Can you complain about police behavior in the same way as a public nuisance? And if you're evicted, will you get support for fighting a retaliatory eviction from this group? And Tony Madrigal is speaking. One of the three people in the room with business suits, Eric Larson. I believe Chief Belcher have business suits.
And they're kind of along here. There's all these guys kind of hanging out here. And maybe they go over here to the community center. Or along the corner here, they do their graffiti. Or they're drinking. So in the park. Okay. Now it's kind of hard when it's in the park. But all of this property here is owned by one property owner. And anything that happens in this area is his responsibility. So if there's graffiti, broken bottles, maybe someone's drinking on the doorstep, or hanging out, or dealing drugs, that's their responsibility for keeping that a safe place for you to live. Or if there's another property down here where you can document always, some sort of ongoing activity, you can hold this other property owner accountable for what's going on in their property.
Raymond is right where the corner of my house is, and that's where they hang out to drink, says translator, translating from a resident. And Eric points it out on the map. And they yell outside the window. Corner of Lee Brand and Raymond. She lives at the apartments right in front of the park. She doesn't know the Santiago family, but Eric is suggesting she lives near them.
So whatever's happening there around your apartment, this sort of strategy can help you. And the way you kind of get started is you first get organized. And you've got to organize your neighbors in such a way that you can take action together. Having regular meetings, or even having a phone tree. Something so simple as knowing the phone numbers of your other neighbors can help you. The real key in this is, documentation. So what you're doing is if you're organizing with your neighbors and you're able to call neighbors whenever there's a problem on a specific property or around a specific property, then you're documenting kind of a date, a time, a place. You're calling police and asking police for an activity number. And maybe taking photographs, or you're doing video. Even kids can go to small claims court with their own drawings and use that as evidence in a small claims case. After you've documented your evidence, then you send your demand letter. And in that demand letter, you want to tell your property owner that you're going to be sued in small claims court. And you need to inform the property owner that there's a problem on the property and that you want it cleaned up. And inform the property owner that if they don't clean things up, that and this continues to cause you emotional and mental distress, and that a nuisance continues to exist, then you're going to go to court. Those are all parts of what you're going to, in a demand letter. Yeah?
Before you send this demand letter, have you talked or any other contact with the landlord about the documentation?
It's, you don't need, in fact, I'd encourage folks not to talk with the property owner before you've collected your information or documentation. Your real kind of preparing this case is getting your documentation together. Once you've got your documentation, then you make your contact with the property owner and say, this is what's going on, and you need to clean it up. You need to clean it up right now. And if you don't clean it up, you're going to get sued. Because what a property owner, they should be visiting their apartments, right? They should be visiting the neighborhood. They should be, you know, seeing what's going on the streets. Otherwise, they're not doing that. They're not being,
responsible.
Very responsible. Scott.
Are you going to talk later about
Scott Kennedy asked.
Yep. I'll have that all.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in small claims court, it's your feelings, your emotions, the stress that you and your family are going through. It's describing how you feel about a drive-by shooting that happened yesterday. Why is it that these guys continue to hang out on my doorstep? That's your documentation. So you don't have to prove like a law that, this isn't like a criminal case. This is civil, where, it's emotional and mental distress. It's got to be on and around the property. So the sidewalk in front of the property.
But we couldn't just say, well, that's near this other property, this property. It's not like one person owns the entire block. So
how near does it have to be? Yes.
Really got to kind of pinpoint it to that specific area, like the telephones. Those telephones are on the property of the sleep type. So what's going on in front of the sidewalk? Any other question?
Well, actually, I kind of answered it. Like, what if all of the activity is happening on the sidewalk and on the street, and none of them is actually happening on the property?
Well, in regards to Bixby specifically, I know that there is
there's a little, you've got this kind of row of houses, and there's this fence here. These guys, when they're drinking, they're going back here to go to the bathroom.
Yep.
You know, they're leaving their bottles and trash on the property. They step onto the property. They're leaning on the fence. They're going to visit tenants who may live in here who may be hiding a stash of heroin or cocaine or whatever, or something else. Or you can also document, you know, like when the tagging happened, you know, a few months ago or even last week, all this graffiti that was on the building, that's evidence. Someone actually had to go onto the property and do that tagging. So that's on.
If I didn't see the tagging happen, I can still notice one.
If you didn't see the tagging happen, but you're still seeing the graffiti.
Right.
And you're seeing the trash and the garbage.
Right.
That's evidence.
And is the evidence you would be like, is it that my front yard, because the window was down, I write that down to
see. You live kind of on this other end of the block, so it's kind of a stretch. But,
But if, like, for instance, documenting that I've seen gambling happening on the sidewalk in front of the property, is that going to do anything useful to me?
Sure, that's evidence.
Even though I'm not actually on the property.
When they're on the sidewalk, that's still on and around the property.
One of the things she knows about, to document your emotions, not just the activities, but your emotions.
The most important thing is to document your emotions, because that's what's depriving you of the quality of life. So you document the activity, you say they were gambling and that made me feel afraid, or they had a loud noise and that woke me up and I lost sleep and I was feeling afraid. It's the feelings and the emotions that you're documenting relating to an activity that relates directly to a property.
Distinguishing between private property and standing on the sidewalk. If the tenants are fearful of saying something to people on the sidewalk, the property owner needs the one who steps up and does that. It all comes back to their property in some way, says this speaker, Michelle. Linda LeMaster speaks.
It's not just your emotions or feelings, but how you're affected. Like, if you have to go out and your kids go to the school and pick up the alcohol bottles, maybe you can't walk away because you had a bad apple before you went out and picked up someone else's bag. That's another kind of effect. If it's messing up your life, but it's just emotional, or in other ways, how it affects you is what you want to document.
In the back of the room, Keith Sugar raises his hand. $5,000 per person is bothered. Can they be sued for $5,000 per piece of property? And Eric says, yeah.
Separate actions, maybe 1 month here and 3 months down the road, then
sugar ass. Best evidence of all, he says. Best evidence is to show physical manifestation of stress.
It's really not even important about physical manifestation.
No, exactly. It's not just positive. What I'm saying is the best case. You can show that you have sleeplessness.
Show sleeplessness, upset stomach, ulcers.
That's really even not necessary.
But Eric says it's not necessary.
That's going above and beyond. Yeah, sure. That's awesome evidence. But...